So, next speaker is Mark McEwen, who's been behind the scenes at this conference. He's now you know what he looks like. And he's going to talk to us honestly about the dishonesty objection in science and Christianity.
Well, a wise person once told you, you never give a talk at a conference that you're involved in running. You totally ignored it. You'll forgive me for not only not having a script, but not having had more than 10 hours of sleep over about 4 days. So I hope you like this, and probably it's best to consider it an advertisement to read my master's thesis. I'll give a link for that at the end. There's no way I can put that all into 20 minutes. But essentially, I'm Mark McEwen. This is the Dishonesty Objection to Christian Faith from Science. So, personal journey. I'm not going to read all of my slides for you, but essentially found out I could be wrong sometimes when I went to seminary and wrote research papers and ended up having to change my thesis 180 degrees for the term paper after I found out my research was showing I was wrong. And particularly, I spent a lot of my life very confident about things like evolution and climate science being hoaxes or wrong, and I found out I was wrong about those things too. And so that kind of wounded me. I carry around this I can be wrong, this feeling with me now. And my wife reminded me the other day, she's like, you know, you say in your talk that you always know you could be wrong. Well, what about now? And so I guess I should be careful about that. But anyway, so doing apologetics papers, writing a lot of, you know, you write about potential contradictions in the Gospels, or I might write about Genesis, but I'm always willing to be self-critical and scrutinize my beliefs in these peripheral matters. But the sinking feeling over the course of my seminary studies, am I exempting the whole show from self-criticism? Am I kind of giving Christianity itself at the very core of the faith? Am I giving it a free pass? Am I just being honest about everything else, but not really self-scrutinizing on the core of my faith? And, of course, how can I be a committed Christian if I do that? Because you read the New Testament and they don't tell you, you know, to test your faith by trying to find out if it's wrong all the time. They, in fact, tell you to not listen to people who are false teachers and don't let them in your homes and watch out for wolves. And anyone who disagrees with this must be a false teacher. And, okay, so how do you work this out? So I spent about 10 years thinking about this, and I'll take less than 10 years today. This is a brief bird's eye view, so here you go. Introduction to the objection. Dawkins put it in a way that was helpful. He says, Christians have their conclusion, their faith in advance. No amount of evidence is going to move them. He says, unlike science books, the Bible is true for Christians, and if the evidence seems to contradict it, you throw out the evidence, not the book. And he's speaking generally about fundamentalist religious people there, but I made them Christians. So let's not make the straw man fallacy. Let's pose this challenge to ourselves in the strongest form before we respond to it. It's called steel manning. And that's what I did in the first chapter of my thesis. Kind of like screw tape letters. So don't think I believe everything I'm about to say. This is what the skeptic would say. So the dishonesty objection might say that science is more open to correction than Christianity. Christian faith is not open-minded toward research questions such as, is Jesus really Lord? We don't go out and investigate that. We don't go out and ask ourselves that. We might investigate, okay, well, is this Bible contradiction or problem a real problem? And we'll investigate that. I don't know anybody who does this. Science is more self-critical than Christianity, trying to falsify our hypothesis. On the other hand, you have Christianity seeking confirmation a lot of the time. And in fact, as an apologetic student, I'm literally engaged in the self-defense of the faith. I guess I'm not a student anymore. I was for 13 years, so I'll have to get over that. But Christianity, of course, tends to explain away from the eyes of the skeptic. People who disbelieve. Well, if you disagree with us, well, I guess you're just rocky soil, or you're blinded by Satan. You're a false teacher. Again, this is what the skeptic would say we say. Are these ad hominem or perhaps the genetic fallacy at work? Science better embraces falsification. Christians often can't even say what it would take for them to dislodge themselves from their faith. Rather, again, we're exhorted to keep it, stand firm in it. So for an outsider, it looks like it is unassailable, non-falsifiable, in principle, at the core, okay? At the core. We've definitely moved on things around, we have whole councils about them and things like that, but at the core, it doesn't seem like we're open to change there. So, in the face of rational scientific arguments against their faith, Christian theologians appeal to other ways of knowing. This is Dawkins' complaint. So, science looking at nature, theology looking at God, keep everything separate, everybody's happy. Dawkins says, we theologians are defining themselves into an epistemological safe zone by talking about other ways of knowing. So they just can't be wrong, because it's just a different thing entirely. This is offside, he says. Can't be falsified. Making it even worse, all science is technically provision, in the sense that you never have license to stop looking at nature. You might be very sure the Earth goes around the sun, but you never have permission to ignore new evidence, if there ever were any. You might be very sure there never will be anything new, but if there were, you would not have license to ignore it as a scientist. Science holds its theories in proportion to the evidence. Christians leap, however, from whatever modest probability we might have to the 100% confidence that makes us preach it. The apostles did not say, hey, this is the best savior we have so far. Further research is forthcoming. probably keep yourself here from the world. But yeah, there might be other prophets. Like, this is not how the New Testament reads. Any scientist who preached their theory is final, and don't look at it. They're not in the seat here. You get a sense that it's not philosophically sensitive enough. Although sometimes scientists use the word fact, whatever they mean by fact cannot mean I have license to never deal with nature again. Right? It's always dependent on nature. So, my thesis was that, the charge that Christian faith is less intellectually honest than science does not follow when you compare the two. In fact, I want to say that our faith can be just as honest about God as the best science is about nature. And this is just one guy giving one answer from one stream of Christianity, and I have nothing to say about whether another denomination or stream or perhaps even another religion might be able to formulate some kind of response along the same lines. This is just the path I found, and here it is. So, I recognize what I call a problem of position. What does the skeptic need to show? Well, the skeptic needs to show that at our best, so not at our worst, because we can be intellectually dishonest about science or politics or anything, just like any other human being, at our best, we cannot hold our faith without being intellectually dishonest. That's what he needs to show. Well, I am not trying to prove that I'm not deluded here. I'm not trying to prove that Christianity is true. I'm only doing what's called negative apologetic, trying to dismantle an objection to the faith. I'm just showing that this objection fails. So I'm not going to try to prove I'm not deluded. It's a different task. So the lack of common ground between the two parties is actually a real problem between Christians and skeptics. It's a problem for the skeptic to make this objection. The objection depends on the idea that we fail to meet some standard called intellectual honesty. But I'm going to say that the skeptic's standard, the terms they bring, excludes our faith in the first place. Do we have enough common ground for this discussion? Well, in some ways, yeah. In some ways, we can agree on some things. Skeptic, I'm sure, would approve of biblical teaching against hating correction, against lying, against using dishonest scales. And I think both of us could agree on some kind of general definition for intellectual honesty. In my research, I came across this, that intellectual dishonesty is a failure to responsibly attend to subtleties involved with reasoning and presentation. So you're not telling a lie itself. The problem is upstream, where you're kind of meddling with, you're gaming things in advance so that people conclude that thing out there that you want them to believe. Now, you're shirking your responsibilities here, and in fact, I distinguish between two forms of this, strong and weak. So if you're strongly intellectually dishonest, you're trying to get people to believe something you think is false. But if you're weakly, well, you believe the thing yourself, you think you're just helping people arrive at something true, so you're willing to just gloss over, not really do your homework, ignore problems behind the scenes. You know, this is the belief that our school, organization, church, or whatever says we have to believe. So we're just going to ignore problems with it, and you know, let students graduate not, you know, believing that there are no problems to be found. For example, I would call that weakly intellectually dishonest. You're not trying to deceive, but you're also not really helping them pursue truth properly on their own. So, actually, I'm going to say there is not enough common ground here, because intellectual honesty, if you think of it as a duty to the truth, that's a real problem if you believe Jesus is the truth. The skeptic's rejection of other ways of knowing denies divine revelation in the first place. In fact, they're insisting that any worthwhile knowledge of God would have to be an observation, not a revelation. I might say a little bit more about that later. So, not enough common ground to have the discussion all the way down. As a thought experiment, think about radical doubts for a moment. If you lost your belief in other minds, or even worse, if you lost your belief that the external world even exists, I'm going to ask you, what argument could get that belief back for you? What non-circular argument could get that belief back for you? Would you not, in fact, if you had a friend who suddenly didn't believe you existed at all, is there anything you could say to him? No, because you're just part of the illusion. And he can only choose to either have faith and kind of jump back into believing what he's experiencing has some value, some truth value, or he doesn't, but there's no non-circular argument at the end. So in both cases, you have to begin with this bare encounter. You either accept it or you don't. My takeaway is that there's nothing intellectually dishonest about accepting an encounter, even if someone else rejects it. So I can still be friends, even though there might with people, even though there might be someone out there who doesn't believe in other minds. I'm not dishonest for doing so. I can't satisfy that person. I can't satisfy a solipsist, but I can still be an honest scientist if I were one. And I want to say I can still be intellectually honest as a Christian, even if I can't satisfy an atheist. Alan Plantinga makes a similar point, so I want to give him credit. At the end of the day, the encounter is its own proof. My encounter with the external world is its own proof. I don't argue my way into believing that there is an external world. So, for friendships, that encounters other people, natural world for science, for revelation for Christianity. This is a matter of authority. And if the skeptic is to understand his Christian faith on in its strongest form, on its own terms, then he needs to appreciate what we really think about revelation. It's not merely an observation. It's, in fact, transcendent in origin, distinctly authoritative, and transformative. So, as a Christian, you know, a Christian can strive for intellectual neutrality and have an apologetic encounter or conversation, but she cannot untransform herself for the sake of a conversation. She can't cease to be a Christian. She can't cease to be conditioned by regeneration, by the Holy Spirit, and all the rest for the sake of a conversation. So that's another problem for actually having common ground all the way down in the discussion. Moreover, I'm going to say it's not intellectually dishonest just to be open to the possibility that there is higher authority than humanity. In fact, I wonder whether it's honest to just assume outright that we are. That seems more suspect. The Bible's explanations of unbelief, rocky soil, that sort of thing, they're not ad hominem attacks if the authority is legitimate. So you probably said you'll understand when you're older to somebody in your lifetime. And if you really are older than that person, you really do have more experience. So you're not making an ad hominem attack or genetic fallacy, what anything. You're just giving the truth that you have more authority than the other party. Or someone else is not a scientist, you are a scientist, you have more authority to say to that person, hey, you're an electrician, you're not an electrical engineer, you're not a physicist, you do not get to say what's true about electrons in the way that a physicist does. So I am an electrician, I pull the wires through the holes, but I have to talk to Arnold Sigma, and he has more authority than I do. when we talk about electrons, right? Even though I probably experienced electrons more directly. I'm ignoring so many jokes coming to my mind right now. Okay, so New Testament authors and apostles also have unique authority. And they can say who a false teacher is if they have unique authority. So, science and theology have similarities. Can't say anything about this, but these authors teach me that science itself does not meet the skeptic's narrowly conceived standard of falsification. So, if science doesn't meet this falsification standard that the skeptics seem often appeal to, why should Christianity feel ashamed if we don't meet it either? But I can't get into that. Thomas Torrance says, for everything we know, there's a way to know it properly. Calls these modalities of reading, or reason, I should say. Find this very helpful. I think of it like this. There's a source of authority that you can't get behind, and a discipline that operates in light of it. And if we think about science and theology this way, you have a project called science, a project called theology. Each of it operates in light of its own proper object. And a lot of the problems with this is the dishonesty objection, which I go into in my thesis but can't mention here, happen by misaligning things in this diagram. But it's free to read. I recommend it. So you have to humble yourself before the object and approach whatever it is according to the terms set by it, not the other way around. Are aware. So science is self-critical by humbling itself before nature, before the physical world. And theology is self-critical in light of its own proper object, which is revelation, Jesus Christ. Trying to do theology apart from revelation would be like trying to do science apart from nature. But what about preaching with authority? So I've gotten this so far, maybe we could deal with some of it, but how do I justify that people preach Christianity as finally true? Well, for this, I talk about some differences. Theology has some very big disadvantages compared to science, and some very big advantages. And the objection ignores these differences, that in theology, we have to deal with the fact not only that we're finite, but that we're sinful. And in theology, again, we have the advantage that we have intimate encounter with the object of our knowledge. God actually reaches out to us, whereas nature does not actively reach out to the scientist and interact spiritually, these sorts of things. Nature does not reach out and transform us. So there's an epistemological inversion. There's a quote you can't read, but I took it away. Science and theology are different. You can't master revelation in the way you might master your field of science. We are not objective, innocent explorers, so says Leslie to begin with really good quotes. You should go read those. The Bible is skeptical about the human heart. I leave that as self-evident. Changing it so fast you can't take pictures. But when it comes to knowledge of God, we have to deal with, the fact that we're sinful, which I already said. So it's not intellectually dishonest to take seriously these warnings in Scripture. It's not intellectually dishonest to think, maybe I should consider whether I have a sin nature and these sorts of things. And again, it seems actually more honest than assuming that we are automatically innocent explorers, like Roman Starship Enterprise. And the only meaningful questions are the ones we have, and we are the good guys in every story. Even though I might be the biggest Star Trek fan in this room, it doesn't inform my theology. So the fact that God gives a share of his own knowledge to us means that we exist differently downstream from this encounter, so that when we preach, we're not preaching on our own observational authority. Preaching with delegated revelational authority. So we can be confident, and in some sense, we can even say that revelation is more objective than science, in the sense that we can be even more intimately in contact with the object of theological knowledge than we can be with the object of scientific knowledge. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. Two kinds of authority here that I don't think I recognize enough in these conversations. When Dawkins criticizes us for holding our faith in a non-traditional way, he is insisting that this is the only kind of knowledge you could have and the only kind of authority we could have. And that's the problem. That's why he's excluding in advance the whole idea of revelation. So that's why I'm satisfied that even though I can't satisfy him, I know I'm not being intellectually dishonest with myself in holding my Christian faith. You can scan the QR code to read the thesis. Thank you very much.
So maybe you could have gone a little quicker on that. The slides will be on the website, and I think you'll put other people's slides on the website too.
Questions. So first off, let's give Mark a standing ovation for all he's done for this conference. And I don't think we could have gotten a better final grand finale talking about the purpose of ASA than what Mark just said. And I was talking with an old timer in regards to creation evolution discussions. I said, what has ASA been like through the years? And he said, well, you know, it's kind of changed. A while ago, it was mostly young earthers. And then it went to intelligent designers, and now it's mostly theistic evolutionists. And I think all of us are trying to deal with the issues that Mark brought up here of being intellectually honest about how do we put together science with faith. So thank you very much, Mark.
You're welcome. Thank you. I noticed the slide had sort of two lamps with a few cones coming out. I noticed that the cones didn't overlap, and that made me reflect, is your mode of thinking equivalent or conditioned by a view of non-overlapping magisteria?
So I did give a talk at ASA 2018, at the same time as Jim Stump, so it was very empty. But you can listen to it, and it was actually on how I compare those things, but essentially I think of the way I relate them. Essentially, when I think about that spectrum of the various models of science and religion, I decided to think of them as points on a graph where, in one direction, you have more and more respect and attention for the legitimacy of that object of knowledge, so increasing regard for revelation going this way, and then at the same time, increasing regard for nature that way. And so over on this side, you have like atheism, and over on this side, you have like Tertullian. What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? Just the total rejection of philosophy and all that stuff. And I essentially what I concluded is you don't even want to be in the middle where you're kind of middling both. You want to be, you know, at the end of the talk, I just raised both lines. I'm like, no, we have to be case by case, always trying to do the best honest justice we can to both objects. And different disciplines will carry those things in different ways. So I think probably revelation doesn't come up very much in pure physics, but it could be a lot more necessary in, say, softer sciences, at least for Christians to reflect on these things. I think they can overlap, and there are disciplines, of course, and I think science and religion, in fact, my talk would be in a spot that where they do overlap. But for the purpose of the objection and my response to it, I didn't need to show that. Thank you for asking. Yes.
Yeah, I have a question about revelation, which is because it then raises the question about which revelations are the true ones, and then if you're going to have some sort of discernment process to figure that out, then isn't the revelation subservient to like the assumptions you're using to evaluate the revelations?
Absolutely.
So I didn't say it here, but I think there are problems of position. And in chapter two, I talk about how there's not just a problem of common ground between me and the skeptic, there's a problem of, the problem is, if I conceive myself as looking down on nature, on the universe, and looking down on my concept of God, and then looking down on God, and being like, okay, yeah, that's my concept, and that's what God really is, well, where am I? I'm a super God, I'm another God. Karl Barth says, it would take another God to know God, you know, in a sense. So this was what it would mean to have observational knowledge of God, to like be able to stand above God and above our concept and match them. And unfortunately, it's also true that if I am to stand above God and stand above every possible religion, and I match them from the outside, then again, I am treating myself as a super God who can do observation. So it really does depend. We really do depend on God for knowledge of God. It's actually like grace is necessary. I am not the author of my own faith. I do stand to you downstream from a transforming encounter, which I cannot undo in any real way. It's irreversible in that sense. And I do talk about Calvinism and Arminianism, and I try to make an argument that's sort of that you can believe either way. I'm only as Calvinist as I was predestined to be, and I choose to go no further. So, all right, does that help?
Yeah.
But it's not easy, and it's important to not fool ourselves into being more satisfied than we can be. I should not feel satisfied that I've looked down and authored my own faith. It doesn't satisfy Dawkins. I expect he would be like, wow, you've really done an elaborate job of fleshing out your self-delusion, right? I go into that as thesis too, but from what I've stated tonight, I think we have a point here.
Oh, hello again. Thank you for your talk. My question that in the beginning you listed a number of things, which is one of them is Christianity cannot, it's not falsifiable, and I don't think that's a good, I believe Christianity is falsifiable in at least one sense, and Paul, St. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians 15, that there people had seen Christ rise from the dead, there were at least 500 people still alive at that time who has witnessed that, and you could go ask them. And if Christ hadn't been risen from the dead, then Christians of most people are most miserable. And our faith does rest on evidence through testimony and historical reasons like that. And if there is evidence that this was false or hoax, then we should stop being Christians. And it can be falsified in that sense, although that's very hard to do. It's, you know, 2,000 years later, you can't really get to the source, you know. But it's similar to other historical things, so it's a different type of verification than an experiment or something. But we do, and we should, but I do think we should have a little bit of that attitude, and the idea of you can't, there was some slide about you become a skeptic and reject Christianity for the sake of, like, getting out of this word. But you can do that to a certain extent. It's part of our experiences. I actually did for a while, and I don't mind.
Can you hold it?
Yeah, we should, it's not wrong, I think, to go through times where you just give up everything and expect and ask God to, if He's real, to work in your life and bring you through to the truth. And you don't want to believe things just because your parents told them to you or something like that. So there's...
Can I just... I'm running out of RAM, but you said two questions,
yeah.
And I want to say... So, first thing, the opening parts was definitely what a skeptic would say. So
yes.
Devil's advocate. So
yeah.
Some of that I agree with. Some of it I'm posing more harshly and strictly than I ever would say myself.
Yeah.
Two, I actually talk a lot. I specifically talk about what if the bones of Christ were found in my last chapter, and I have like a big section on that. So read my thesis. But I want to say there's a difference between Christianity being falsifiable then, like in the days after the resurrection, that sort of thing, and being practically falsifiable now.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between the fact in 1 Corinthians 15 that, like, the theological facts. Remember, in 1 Corinthians 15, what's Paul doing? He's not trying to make an apologetic to the Corinthians saying, hey, Christ is raised, therefore Christianity is true. No, he's talking to people, he's talking to Greeks who disparage the material. They don't want to believe that there's a spirit or a fleshly body that's raised in any sense. So he's trying to say, no, you can't reject bodily resurrection. Because if you did, guess what? You reject this thing you already believe in. You believe Jesus was raised. You are Christians. So if apologists will often, like at Easter sometimes, the pastor will talk about this. Here's all the evidence for the resurrection. But it's interesting how Paul's logic is kind of aimed in the other direction. So he's trying to prove one thing, and people are taking it and trying to prove this, and I'm not saying it's false. I do believe that Jesus was bodily resurrected, and I do believe that if he weren't, our faith would be false. But there's a difference between stating that dependency and then saying to an atheist, I have a falsifiable faith because if the bones of Christ were found, therefore I would give up my faith. So the problem is, one, you could never verify that this find was true. I suppose somebody says, I mean, there even was a few years ago, and the problem is, there's no way to verify that it's Jesus. And so, it's not really a live falsification criteria. It's not, like, when a scientist does an experiment, sets up, like, this is how I will know my theory is false, or not. There's a live criteria. Like, it's really possible to tell either way, but this is just kind of a statement we say, but there's nothing really at stake in it, right? Now, what's the other question, though?
Oh,
the other thing was, you can't untransform yourself for the sake of argument. No, I do think, I mean, this actually, my whole exercise in
scrutinizing. Brains is,
So I think there's a difference between the autobiographical truths of how you came to Christ, how you think of your faith, and then what's actually happening on an ontological level, on a spiritual level. Like, I might say I'm a Christian because I read some apologetics book, but really, if I'm a Christian, it's because the Holy Spirit has transformed me, and it's an ongoing transformation. That's the real why. And if Seth were here, you could talk about different causes. But I don't know which ones are which anymore.
Okay, well, sorry, we're out of time. And thank you again, Mark.
Well, thank you.